Thank you. It's good to be back again. And welcome to everyone who's listening, whatever part of the day it is, whatever part of the year it is. You've joined another episode of Broken Bread. And that's courtesy of Mike Coles at newliferadio.co.uk and myself, Ron Bailey, at BibleBased.com. And welcome to study number 5 in our series where we are looking into a book. It's a book that I wrote some years ago now called The Better Covenant, and I'm trying to provide a study guide so that people can dig a bit deeper into these things if they want to, and maybe to cast some light on some of the mysteries that I introduced into the book. So welcome. We really are pleased to have you with us, and we look forward to getting to know you a little bit better as we share these times together. So let's make a start, because we've got a lot of ground to carry tonight. In fact, I want to cover about 430 years, I think it is, tonight. And we've got, what, half an hour?
Ish.
Okay. Let me introduce it with just some thoughts of the way I understand this book and this series. Let's establish an important point right from the start of our journey. We're providing a study guide for The Better Covenant. This is the book that I wrote almost 10 years ago. So the topic of our studies here is the New or Better Covenant. And when we speak of new or better, we're using the language of contrast. New means there must be an old. And better means there must be a less good or worse. We're using the language of contrast. And in the prophecies of Jeremiah and in the New Testament epistle to the Hebrews, the point is to show the contrast between the old and the new covenant now. Some regard the new covenant as a broadening or deepening of the old covenant. Some say that there's no difference in essence between these covenants, but only a difference in the externals of ceremonies. This cannot be true. And the Better Covenant was written by me to underline that point. The New Covenant is different to and better than the Old Covenant. That is the basic theme of the Better Covenant and the theme of this study guide. So we've been tracing some basic ideas that are associated with the word covenant. There are more to follow, but let's catch our breath and take the time to see that although the New Covenant uses the language of many ancient covenants, it's different to and better than them all. Let's underline this truth. But in particular, it was distinctly new as compared with the old and better. We need to identify which of the many covenants the Bible is referring to as the Old Covenant. Some bundle them all together in their minds. But the adjectives new and better are pointing back in particular to the Old Sinai Covenant, often known as the Mosaic Covenant, on account of its mediator, Moses. So let's do our familiar thing, which is to set the scene and turn to this issue of context, context, context. We don't want to just take verses at random and string them together in our own necklace according to our own design. We want to put them into the context of the great flowing revelation of the purposes of God. So we'll have a look, first of all, at just checking the calendar. This is Paul writing to the Galatians, and we did some studies in the letter to the Galatians not so long ago, which are still available if you're interested in following them up. This is chapter 3, verse 15 to 18. Paul is speaking to people who were in danger of diverting, and instead of trusting Christ alone for their salvation, wanted to add something to it in the sense of beginning to add the laws of Israel and the ceremonies of Israel and the practices and the cultural practices of Israel, thinking that that made them better qualified. And of course, if you add anything to something that is perfect, you can only make it imperfect. Is that logical? If you add anything to something which is perfect, you can only spoil it. This is Paul, Galatians 3, verse 15. Brethren, I speak in the manner of men. Though it is only a man's covenant, yet if it is confirmed, no one annuls or adds to it. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is Christ. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, now you see why I said we were going to try and cover 430 years. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by God to Christ, that it should make the promise of no effect. For if the inheritance is of the law, it is no longer of promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. Now there's actually a devotional series that I again did some time ago called The Steps of Abraham that's in our blog posts that covers these things in detail, and it'll provide extra background for these things. So you can get it from here if you're looking at the online notes that I use as my prompts for these studies, and you'll see there'll be a link there to the blog posts on Abraham, my friend. So let's have a look at Abraham's Jehovah covenants. You remember that there was, first of all, we touched on this last week, there was Abraham's Amorite covenant with the Amorite brothers. That ended, and Abraham raised his hand in oath, that is, trust and loyalty. His trust and loyalty would be in Jehovah alone. This is Abraham's response to the revelation of Melchizedek, but at this stage is not a covenant. There follow two covenants that link Jehovah and Abraham. We're going to look at covenants with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When Abraham was about 70 years old, this is why I say we'll see if we can follow the calendar. When Abraham was about 70 years old, he left Ur of the Chaldees in between the rivers, and he transferred to Haran, which was about 190 miles, I think, something like that, 130 miles northwest of Ur of the Chaldees. And then when he was about 70 years old, these are approximate ages, when he was about 70 years old, he left Ur of the Chaldees. When he was about 73 years old, he left Haran on the second leg of his journey, which was to bring him south down into the Promised Land. So let's have a look at this covenant. I'm calling it the first covenant here, and it's from Genesis chapter 15, and it's round about 1913 years before Christ. In other words, it's about 10 years after Abraham left Haran. He's now about 83 years old. This happened on a particular day. It happened on the same day that Abraham came to the place of believing entirely in God with no additions, just God alone, for his well-being and for God's purposes to be worked out in his life. That's what we call justifying faith. And Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6 is a very famous verse quoted several times in the New Testament. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. On that same day, a strange thing happened that we will come back to later on. It came to pass, I'm reading now from Genesis chapter 15 and verse 17. It came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold a smoking furnace and a flaming torch that passed between these pieces. In that day, Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, and the Kenizzite, and the Kadmonite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. When Paul comments on this moment of faith, when God declared Abram to be right with him on the basis of Abram's complete trust in God, Paul writes this, Galatians chapter 3 and verse 16. Now to Abraham and his seed, did you notice that? It says, in that day, I've gone back up to Genesis 15, in that day Jehovah made a covenant with Abraham saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land. Now Galatians chapter 3 and verse 16. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to your seed. I'm not going to repeat my Galatians studies here. They're available if you want to follow them up. And to your seed. And then a little bit later on in chapter 3 of Galatians, Paul says this, what purpose then does the law serve? What's the law all about if all we need is faith in God? What purpose then does the law serve? And then he says, again, this is all in our previous studies, it was added because of transgressions until the seed should come to whom the promise was made. Now, this is really a vital verse to us to understand, because although this promise was made with Abraham, it was actually made for the seed. Let's remind ourselves. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a flaming torch that passed between these two ways. In that day, Jehovah made a covenant with Abraham, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land. Now, we looked at Stephen's testimony last week, and we saw that he said Abraham didn't even have a place that he could put his foot on. To me, that conjures up a kind of a picture of Abraham standing on one leg and just one footprint, and even that wasn't his in this land. It was never his. But in this covenant, God sealed it to his seed. And obviously people immediately think, oh yes, it means Isaac. But Paul says he means more than Isaac. I'm going back to Galatians chapter 3 verse 19 now. What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. This is a very mysterious thing. It seems as though in some way, in the events that took place at this time when Abraham was effectively in a trance, an agreement was made between God and the seed. Yes, it makes you pause, doesn't it? Although Abraham is the agent in this covenant, according to Paul in Galatians, this covenant promise was really between Jehovah and Abraham's seed. And he says here that the seed is Christ. This is the first reference to a covenant with Abraham that was where the people who were involved in it were Jehovah and Abraham. So, in that day, and what was that day? Well, that was the day of Jehovah's promise to Abraham to be his shield and exceeding great reward, the day that Abraham was justified by faith. It was the day of a mystical event that Abraham witnessed while in a trance, a deep sleep. It's the same word for a deep sleep that's used of Adam, when he slept and God brought forth the rib from which he built Eve. In that day, this is the language, in that day Jehovah cut covenant this is an interesting thing too, that the idiomatic way, the way that it was always done in Old Testament times, when it talks about making a covenant or creating a covenant, the Bible always uses the word cut, because this was the way they made covenants in ancient times. They would slaughter animals and cut them in half and create an avenue of death. Then the two covenant parties would approach one another from either end and make their vows to each other, the implication being a little bit like a boy, a child, saying, "I'll cross my heart and hope to die if I break my promise to you." This was this picture of a covenant being made in the valley of death. I won't go into this because we'll go back to it. But in that day, God cut a covenant with Abraham. This promise of the land for his son. And you think, this is wonderful. Now Abraham is really to the place now where he can begin to accomplish God's purposes for him. And then we come into chapter 16 of Genesis, which is an amazing disaster. This is about 3 years after that covenant where Abraham in his trance witnessed a covenant being made between, I believe, God and the seed. He's 86 years old now. And what happens, of course, was this. When Abraham was 86 years old, then Hagar bore Ishmael to Abraham. Disaster. Disaster. This promise has continued in God's heart and in Abraham's heart, that Abraham would be given children and that God had a purpose for these children. But the days went on and nothing happened, and nothing happened, and the weeks went on and the months and a year and another year. What are we going to do? We need to give God a help, seems to have been the strategy. Sarah's strategy. But Abraham falls in with it. And the consequence is the birth of Ishmael, who has the right father, but the wrong mother, for God to fulfill his purposes. And then you go into chapter 17, and this is one of the things I wanted to make clear, that sometimes it's difficult to appreciate how quickly time can go in the Bible. For example, in the gap between the end of chapter 16 and the beginning of chapter 17, that little strip of white that you have breaking up the text into passages, in that period of time, that is 13 silent years, where there is no recorded word from God to Abraham. And Ishmael grows into a young boy, a young man of 13. 13 silent years. And then in chapter 17, we have this extraordinary thing. Abraham is now 99 years old. It was approximately 30 years after Abraham's obedient journey from Ur that the Abrahamic covenant was cut. This is an important thing. This Abrahamic covenant did not come into being in Genesis chapter 15. It comes into being 30 years, well, several years later, as we've seen, in chapter 17. It was approximately 30 years after Abraham's obedient journey from Ur that the Abrahamic covenant was cut. Its sign was circumcision. Abraham's steps of faith took 30 years before this covenant was established. This is what Paul writes in Romans chapter 4. That Abraham, he says earlier, he says he's the father of all believers, and then he says, and he's the father of those, he's the father of the circumcision, to those who not only are of circumcision, but who also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham, while still uncircumcised. We're in the gap. In chapter 15, Abraham is uncircumcised. In chapter 16, Abraham is uncircumcised and fathers Ishmael. We come now into chapter 17, and it will be as the consequence of a covenant that God makes with Abraham now that Abraham will become circumcised. The father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. And then it says this in Hebrews, therefore from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the promises. This is such a key statement here in Hebrews. None of these immediately succeeding generations actually received the promise that God was speaking of. Oh yes, later on some of them came into their possession of the land, but even that did not fulfill all that God had intended. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. It goes on to say that God had some better purpose. In Exodus chapter 2, and remember, Exodus is a long time after the end of Genesis. It flows on, but there's hundreds of years in between the two. And God heard their groaning. There, that's the people that we call now the people of Israel. He heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Let's just dig a little bit deeper. In the narrative, that's the Bible storyline, the relationship with Isaac is called an oath, but frequently the unbroken linkage from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob seems to be emphasized by referring to the covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. But sometimes the fact that there is no reference to a covenant with Isaac in the narrative seems to be recorded precisely. This is Psalm 105. He is Jehovah our God, his judgments are in all the earth. He has remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations. Listen to how it's expressed. The covenant which he made with Abraham, his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob. It's interesting that God made covenant with Abraham, and he made a covenant with Jacob. He made an oath to Isaac. But it bundles them all together because it's really the continuation of this one covenant. He confirmed the same unto Jacob for a statute. Now, let's have this clear in our minds, if we can. That Abraham, after his battle with the kings and his encounter with Melchizedek and his own response in raising his hand to swear his loyalty to God, that only God will be make him rich and that only God will be his provider. And God speaks to him and says, Abraham, don't be afraid. I am your shield and your exceeding great riches. And then we're into chapter 15. And after that, Abraham asks a question. And he says, I think he asks this with a heavy heart. I don't think he's harsh with God. I don't think he's complaining bitterly. He just simply says, what's the point of it? I don't have any heirs except my chief steward, this Eliezer of Damascus. And at that point, God takes him out and says, look up to the stars, and he sees the stars, and God says to him, I will give you a seed. If you can count them, then you'll know how many children there are going to be. Amazing kind of promise. And then you have this foundational truth of the Bible. Abraham believed in Jehovah. And God reckoned it to him for righteousness. Wonderful. But that wasn't the old covenant that Jeremiah and Hebrews is talking about. And then you have personal promises that are made to God, by God to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, Israel. But that isn't the old covenant either. We have to wait for it. Look how the story re-begins in Exodus chapter 3. And God said moreover unto Moses, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name for ever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. You see, in these early chapters of the Bible, there are amazing transitions that take place, and I'm going to end by just drawing attention to them. To begin with, God is speaking to individuals. He speaks to a Noah. He speaks to an Abraham. He speaks to an Isaac. He speaks to an Israel and Jacob. These are individuals, and God makes individual promises to them. But as the time goes on and the family begins to come, the children of Israel, as to say the sons of Jacob, that forms into kind of a patriarchal society in which Israel, Jacob was his first name, is the head of that family community. It's patriarchal. But later on, as a result of the famine, the children of Israel, that's to say the descendants of Jacob Israel, and their household travel to Egypt. They've almost become like clans now, as to say each one, Reuben, Levi, Simeon, Judah, and the rest of them, all of them have their own family units. It's almost as though they've become like clans. Yes, they're all part of the children of Israel, but they have their different identities, and they have their different associations. And then when that community come down into Egypt, and they're in Egypt for some hundreds of years, the community, these children of Israel, these clans, merge into what I'm going to call the community of Israel in Egypt. And for anyone who's interested in the whole question of what elders are and where they come from, the first time we read of Israel's elders is in the story of the Exodus, where God tells Moses to call the elders so that he can pass a message unto them. Israel had no elders until they were in Egypt. But by the time they were in Egypt, at this point in Exodus, they had become an organized people group, a community, and they had their elders who were in some way the middlemen. They were answerable clearly to Pharaoh and his taskmasters. They had become essentially a nation within a nation. But they were not yet God's nation. For that, God must bring them to Sinai, because becoming God's nation is the consequence of the Sinai covenant. And it is the Sinai covenant which is our destination, where we shall start this trail again next week. So thank you so much for being with us today and sharing this time together. And God willing, we look forward to your company again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.